catering services at 351-6209. Today's broadcast is made possible by the U of I's Center for Advanced Study, whose MillerCom 2005 lecture series presents The Real Meets the Imagined, Northwest Coast Art, Claude Lévi-Strauss, and Surrealists by Marie Mosé, George A. Miller Endowment Visiting Professor, UIUC and Senior Researcher, CNRS, Laboratory of Social Anthropology, Paris, on Thursday, March 31st at 7:30 p.m. at Knight Auditorium in Spurlock Museum. For more information, go to www.cas.uiuc.edu. Today's programming is made possible with support from the University YMCA, presenting an evening of food and music at the 22nd Annual International Dinner and Performance Night at the University YMCA on Sunday, March 6th from 6 to 8 p.m. There will be food from over 30 countries plus performances from the Philippines, Africa, India, and other countries. For more information, call 337-1500.
Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and at the controls, Henry Frain. Well, in the years since Title IX was passed, this was in the early 70s, a large number of girls and young women have become involved in sports. And they played just about every sport there is, basketball and hockey, softball, swimming, gymnastics, they're in martial arts, they're just about everywhere. And generally speaking, we think that that's a good thing. Participation by girls in sports is a good thing. There is, however, one sport where women's participation seems to make us kind of uneasy, and that is boxing. In spite of that unease and the fact that maybe it doesn't quite square well with what we think women are supposed to be, it does seem to be that a small but growing number of women has been drawn to the sport of boxing. And this morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll see if we can get some insight into that phenomenon. And our guest for the program is Leah Hager-Cohen. She has authored a new book that's out here recently. It's titled Without Apology, Girls, Women, and the Desire to Fight. It is published by Random House. And it is in part about her experiences getting to know a woman who has coached young girls who were interested in boxing, and also some of her, that is Ms. Cohen's experience getting into the ring herself, something that when she started in on this whole story, she would have thought she would have no interest at all in doing and might indeed have felt the idea a little bit repellent. We'll talk about all of this in this part of Focus 580. And of course, people who are listening are welcome to call if you have questions, comments. We only ask callers to be brief just so we can keep the program moving. But anybody who is interested is welcome to join the conversation here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line so that if it would be a long-distance call, use that number, 800-222-9455. Again, for Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Ms. Cohen, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Appreciate it. Just, we should explain, I guess, at the beginning how it is you got into this story and how you ended up getting interested in boxing. And it was really a matter of accident, as you explain. A friend of yours who was a photographer said that she was going to this boxing club where she had heard there were some girls training with this woman coach. And she, this photographer friend, just said to you, well, would you like to come along and kind of, you know, see what it's all about? And you said, sure. And that's how it started.
Yes, that's right. And as you said, when I said sure, I was, you know, a little bit reluctant, but my curiosity overtook my reluctance.
Hmm. What would you have if before this whole thing had started, if I had met you and I said something like, so what do you think about boxing? What was your attitude at that point?
I would have said, I think boxing is sick and I don't see why anyone would find it pleasurable or sporting, you know, to try to knock somebody else unconscious.
And so that seems probably a fairly widespread attitude toward boxing. I would expect this would be gendered in some sense, that probably I would expect people who were interested, and that's what we would expect too, that people were interested. We think, well, probably that would be men mostly, and that probably women would be really turned off by the whole idea.
Yes, and actually that's consistent with my memories as a child. my father and my uncle and my grandfather, you know, occasionally at family gatherings, they'd be sitting in a room around a TV watching a boxing match. And I loved and respected these men, and it was intriguing to me that they liked boxing. But I was also very influenced by my, you know, mother and aunt and grandmother. I could tell that they thought it was repulsive and that I was a girl and I was sort of meant to feel as they felt.
Well, that does get at some very basic ideas about what it means to be a man and what it means to be a woman and what you're supposed to be like and what your sensibilities are supposed to be. That's kind of part of the program that we're handed, that, guys are supposed to be interested in things like football and boxing, and that women are supposed to not. They're supposed to be turned off by it. And in fact, that if we came across a woman who was interested in boxing, we would probably say, something's wrong with this woman.
Yes. And it's a puzzle to me now. You know, I'm in my late 30s now, and I'm not sure how much of my sense growing up that I was by nature not an aggressive person. I'm not sure how much of that was there on its own and how much of it was contained in subtle messages that were being sent to me my whole life. You know, that as a girl, I was supposed to feel that I was not an aggressive person.
Well, tell me, you made that first trip there in 2001 to this gym. It was in the Boston area, and met this woman who was the coach, Rafaela Johnson, who was coaching these girls. What was your first impression of her?
She was not what I expected. I knew that she herself was also the first female New England Golden Gloves champion. And I thought that she would be tough. I thought she'd be kind of physically imposing. I thought that her manner would be a bit gruff and tough. And I suppose I thought that she would seem a little bit masculine to me. And in fact, it was almost like looking in a mirror. She was small. She was, you know, light of coloring. She was a little bit shorter than I was. She was kind of skinny, except she had really muscular arms. She had a very feminine voice, and she was wearing, you know, she had her hair pulled back in a pink scrunchie. So that was a shock.
Mm-hmm. You explained that, as you mentioned, that she was the first Golden Gloves boxing New England. She was the first female New England Golden Gloves champion, and was a skilled fighter. She's also a painter. She has an interesting story. How did she come to boxing?
She was in her early 20s, and she had a lot of anger. She knew that she liked, she was taking a class at her local health club that had a cardio boxing, it offered cardio boxing, and she liked it. It connected with her in a way, the experience of, you know, putting on gloves and hitting the bags, and hitting the mitts, the trainer's mitts. And when she asked the instructor whether she could do, you know, real boxing, he laughed at her and said women would never do real boxing. And that just, you know, got her hackles up. And she went home and looked in the yellow pages and found a real old school boxing gym and rode her bike over in the pouring rain that afternoon and walked in with kind of a real chip on her shoulder and spoke to these grizzled old trainers who were sitting there and said, you know, you have to teach me to box. And they kind of looked at her and raised their eyebrows. And one guy said, you know, all right, punch my hand. And she just punched it as hard as she could. And he kind of, you know, cocked his eyebrow and said, all right, I guess I will.
Mm. I think that probably the fighters, professional boxers that maybe have gotten a lot of attention either are those people who seem really nice, oddly nice for people who do what they do, and those people who seem pathological. And probably it's the ones who are pathological, the ones who seem to be nothing but trouble in the ring and outside of the ring are the ones that get a lot of attention.
Yes.
And you talked about the fact that maybe they're that people who are attracted to boxing are people who do have, as we say, some anger issues. And also there's an interesting idea in the book that you touch on here and there, that people – who are involved in boxing and work with boxers have this idea that there's something about them that is damaged, and that for them, the activity of boxing is related to demons, and I guess ultimately it can result in a kind of exercising the demons. But do you think the people who are attracted to boxing, who want to hit, who want to get in there, and they not only do they want to hit the heavy bag, they want to hit another person, that all of those people do have what it is it's pent-up anger, it's just looking for a way to get out?
I think that, I guess I have a two-part answer. One is, I do think, and I heard over and over again from people at the gym, that there is a connection between, as you said, demons and wanting to engage in this sport. But what I learned over time through other people and through my own experience was that it wasn't a simple equation where, as I might have originally thought, where boxing and hitting another person is a means of getting out anger that you're carrying around. I was amazed to learn that sparring, when it's done right, and when you're not talking about, you know, a pathological extreme case, sparring contains no anger. There is no anger at your sparring partner. If anything, there is just respect and concentration and gratitude to the other person for being in the ring with you so that you can both challenge yourself and figure out why it is you're there in the first place. People seem to be boxing more as an internal struggle than as a fight against the other person. And it looks to spectators like, you know, you're beating up on some other person, and so you're sort of violent and dangerous and angry. But getting closer to the sport, it seems more about a means of tapping into possibly anger, but then also a kind of empowering, liberating strength and clarity about your own survival ability. That was the more dominating atmosphere in the gym.
Now, my guess is that that is something that operates also in other sports. Perhaps that's also the reason, who knows, that people climb mountains and drive race cars and do those kinds of things. So one might still have to ask, well, boxing, though, it's a little bit different than those other things. It's not, you can see in those other things how someone would be testing themselves or where they would get the kind of pure pleasure that comes from using the body, from knowing that you're doing something and that you're really good at it, something where you're challenged, but not to the point where you're challenged and it's more than you can do, but it's a challenge that you're actually capable of meeting. You know, you could do that on skis, you could do that running, you could do that on a bicycle, you could do that. You could also do that playing team sports that were not contact sports. That seems to sort of bring me round to the idea that, yes, all those things are true, and yet something about boxing is, there's something different about it.
I think that you're absolutely right. And it's funny, my editor on this book is like a killer tennis player. And as I would hand her chapters, she kept saying, oh, I get this. This is just like, you know, what I'm experiencing when I play tennis. And so I think there's something about the boxing experience that translates to other sports and endeavors. But I also think you're right that there's something different. And what I focused on is really how the experience is different for women and girls. There are so many messages, really confusing messages that we ingest about being non-aggressive, which can also translate into being passive and into being weak. And by the time you reach adulthood, if you have ingested these messages and internalized them well enough, you may be operating at a real psychological disadvantage and at an unhealthy disadvantage, you know, sort of not as a whole human being.
Mm-hmm. Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Leah Hager-Cohen, and she is a writer. She's authored several books, both fiction and nonfiction. This book that we're talking about here this morning is titled Without Apology, Girls, Women, and the Desire to Fight. It is published by Random House, and it has come out just fairly recently. It's out there in the bookstores if you want to read it. Questions are welcome to 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, I mentioned just at the beginning that the reason that the way that you sort of got into this, your way into the story, was when you were invited by a friend who was a photographer to just kind of go along for the ride. She was going to go to take some pictures of this woman that we have talked about, Rafaela Johnson, and some of the girls that she was working with. So also in the book, you introduce us to the Rodriguez sisters. There are three sisters, 15, 12, and 10 at the time, and a friend. The friend of the oldest of the Rodriguez girls, a young woman named Nikki Silvano. Tell me about the girls.
I was so crazy about these girls. They had this kind of infectious, life spark about them, and they could be really angry and funny and, sweet and just sort of cuckoo. And I spent a lot of time with them, and over time, they all told me stories about themselves that I found their relationship to their own physical aggression kind of shocking, because it was so different from what I had experienced as a kid. These were girls who all had gotten into pretty violent street fights in their lives. They were growing up in a neighborhood where there was a lot of violence. There were people doing drugs openly on the streets. There were quite regular reports of murders and gunfights and rapes that they were just growing up with in their project. So for them, a certain kind of violence was a fact of daily life. And for all of them, it wasn't until they began to box in the gym that they could separate their own physical strength and aggression from something that they had to bring with them and which could be ignited very easily at school or at home or on the street. They began to gain some discipline and a measure of peace inside themselves. So even as they became stronger gym fighters, they were becoming stronger fighters of a different kind in terms of discipline in relationships and in schoolwork and at home. Mm.
I think that's something that's very interesting, an interesting part of the story, and I think that some people would find maybe a little counterintuitive, the idea that kids who had anger management issues, given the opportunity to channel their aggression into the ring, would in fact help them do that and then use that energy in the ring, but in a sense keep it there or leave it there, and not end up making them somehow more violent in their daily lives when they weren't boxing. But in fact, it seemed to have made them less so.
Yeah, one of the most surprising things to me the very first night I went to the gym was, I couldn't square it in my mind, but I had this really strong sense that the gym was a wholesome place. And that was the last thing I had expected. But all of the boxers and trainers who were in there, from young to old, there was this sense of almost gentleness and respect and discipline. It felt like a very, very safe place to be. And so I think that, the kids who come to the gym and who have had trouble, controlling their aggressive impulses, to learn the discipline, and to learn that they have it within themselves to be disciplined about their aggressive impulses, is, I think, for them in some ways a relief and a liberation, and affords them a measure of peace that they didn't previously have. And over again, I'd meet these old men at the gym who would tell me their life stories and all the people they'd grown up with who'd wound up in jail or killed. And they would talk about how boxing had saved them. They really believed that.
One thing that's really clear that emerges here is that a very strong bond develops between Rafaela, the coach, and the girls. And it's, you know, sometimes it looks like big sister, little sister. Sometimes it looks like mother, daughter. It's really clear that there is a very, very strong emotional attachment that perhaps you see in a lot of mentoring relationships.
That's right.
You certainly saw that.
Yeah, and when you just use the word, you know, mentoring relationships, that's exactly what I was thinking of. You know, it doesn't just have to be with a boxing coach, and it doesn't even just have to be with a coach. You know, it can be with your tutor in school. But I know that, you know, you hear so much that especially for kids who are having a rough time, having one mentor, one positive adult role model can make a huge difference. And Rafi was... She knew that she functioned in this way in the kids' lives, more than wanting them to be good boxers and more than wanting them to, you know, take the sport to its limits in terms of competition or even turning pro. Those were not her goals for them so much as having them gain from their experience at the gym, you know, something healthy and sustaining that they could take with them, you know, whether that be in their relationship with her or just in what they learned about themselves that they'd take into the rest of their lives.
Mm. She, and I'm sure that everybody involved in this, knows full well that boxing can be dangerous and people can get badly hurt. And in fact, she, Rafaela, had certainly had reason to know because she knew another boxer, a man, who died, actually, after a fight. And so she certainly knows just how dangerous that is. And you could say that if the other boxers were adults, that then you could say, well, you know, you're grown up, you're capable of making your own decisions, you want to get in the ring, that's entirely up to you. Now, here in a situation where she was working with these girls, she was responsible not just for, you know, maybe what happened to another fighter, but they were also children. How did she think about the possibility that these girls could really be seriously injured?
She took her role as the person in charge of their safety and health so seriously. And I learned from her what is now my bias, which is I am in favor of amateur boxing, and I have a lot of problems with professional boxing. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons is because I think that strictly in terms of safety, the two sides of the sport are so different. So in amateur boxing, you know, the most obvious difference is the boxers wear headgear. They only go, you know, three or four rounds tops, but usually it's only three rounds. So in professional boxing, you know, you can box 15 rounds. So much more damage can happen over that length of time. You can go back to the fight with a bad cut because you're allowed to use, you know, congealants to stop the bleeding. You're not allowed to do that in amateur fighting. Rafi refuses to work the corner for somebody at a professional fight, and she tells the kids, you know, that she's in favor of them doing amateur boxing, but she never encourages any of them to turn pro. And in fact, she sent me to, you know, I asked if I could interview some of her former boxers who weren't boxing any longer, and so I interviewed a bunch of them, and I came back to Rafi, and, you know, I said, are you kind of sad that they dropped it, that they're not still with the sport? And she said, no, that's her goal for them, is that they do it for as long as it's vital and they're getting something from it, you know, and then they get out with no damage done and they remember the lessons from boxing.
How did the girls' parents feel about their doing this?
The parents were all really proud of their girls' physical strength and ability. I do notice a difference, a class difference, between reactions of parents of, you know, middle class kids, and kids who are growing up in poverty and in dangerous neighborhoods. There seems to be a higher value, if you're growing up in a neighborhood that's openly dangerous, a higher value on girls' strength and ability to defend themselves. And even though there are still a lot of gender stereotypes around femininity, there's less of a taboo on girls being physically strong.
And how, I wonder how the other girls that these girls knew, that they knew from school or knew outside, the girls who were not involved in this, how did they think about these girls?
Most of their peers were impressed and respectful. The older two girls at the gym, they were sophomores in high school at the time, and there were girls in their school who would sort of taunt them and make suggestions that they weren't feminine enough if they were boxers, or that they must be lesbians if they were boxers. What was amazing to me was to watch these two girl boxers not succumb to the temptation to get into battle with these girls who were, trying basically to lure them into losing control. I think also the fact that they had so much love and respect for their coach, who is a very feminine woman, that helped them to know that you can be a strong, skilled female boxer without giving up any bit of your femininity. And they were growing into themselves as young women so beautifully. And by the end of the year that I really followed them closely, they had really won their peers and their teachers over. You know, people were proud of what they could do.
Yeah, that gets at something that I'm sure that is true. I guess I would think maybe this would be male boxers would have to deal with more, but maybe women too. That is, if it's known that that's what they do, guys, you know, trying to push them, saying, oh, you're a boxer, huh? I think you're pretty tough, huh? Well, let's see what you got. You know, that kind of stuff. And them on a regular basis, on probably an almost daily basis, having to avoid people who want to fight.
That did happen to them a little bit, but Rafi told them, you know, on day one, if you begin boxing with her, you know, she tells the kids that there is no boxing allowed outside the gym. The line gets drawn really clearly on that first day, and that she will not train anybody who gets into fights outside the gym. And then once they got their licenses from USA Boxing, which is the amateur sanctioning body in the country. And once their licenses, which arrive in the form of, they look sort of like little white passports, and they arrived in the mail, and once the girls were in possession of those USA Boxing licenses, you know, they were so precious to them. They wouldn't do anything to jeopardize those licenses. And if they had gotten into fights outside the gym, their licenses would have been revoked.
Well, we're at our midpoint, just a little bit past the midpoint here. Let me again introduce our guest. We're talking with Leah Hager-Cohen. She's a writer, has written a number of books, both nonfiction and a couple of novels. Her most recent is about women in boxing, and it's titled Without Apology, Girls, Women, and the Desire to Fight, and it's published by Random House. It's just come out. If you're interested, you can look for it in the bookstore. We also certainly would welcome people into the conversation. Maybe you have questions or comments. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I must say, I think it's a very engaging piece of writing. We talk with a lot of authors on this show, and because there are so many, I end up having to do a lot of skimming. And if I come across a book that won't let me skim it, I know there's got to be something there because you keep finding yourselves just being pulled into the story. So I think it's a good piece of writing.
Thank you.
And I think you should send a copy to Bill Littlefield.
Yes.
Yeah. Tell me about your experience now. At some point here, after having watched Rafi and the girls and other people at the gym, because this was also a gym that was frequented by boys and by men, by male fighters, so it was a mixed sort of group. At what point did you say to yourself, I want to try this?
Well, it's funny because I thought it took me probably a few months before I said I wanted to try it too. And when I went back and looked through my notes and I saw that it had been not even really 2 weeks, I was amazed. I didn't realize the transformation had been that fast. But the truth is, I think the transformation began for me the first night I was in the gym, and I realized I had this feeling in me. It was like I'd had all these cups of coffee and my stomach was kind of a flutter. And I realized later that the feeling I had was jealousy, that I wanted to be like these girls in the ring. I wanted to do what they were doing and, you know, not have to be sort of, not have to apologize for myself, but just to get out there and do what they were doing and see if I could do it too.
Hmm. That seems, I guess, somebody listening to the conversation at the beginning, and you're talking about the fact that when you were a girl and boxing was on television, you thought that was not very interesting. You certainly didn't want to watch and was pretty turned off by it, and would have said that that's the way that you'd felt even in 2001, before you first went down to the gym and got to know Rafi and the girls and saw what they were doing. All of that seems you wouldn't have that attraction. You wouldn't have that interest. You wouldn't want to do it. You wouldn't look at yourself in the mirror and say, I'm somebody who could be a fighter.
That's true. It was really, really a surprise to me. I think that for me, the whole word aggression, I actually researched, you know, where does the word come from? And the etymology goes back to the same root as the same as the root for the word desire. And when I learned that, it was like this light bulb going off over my head. It made so much sense to me because as a female in this culture, I have always felt really ambivalent about even having desire, let alone expressing it as something legitimate. You know, and I always felt like if I had desire for me that wasn't about wanting to take care of and nurture other people, you know, that I had to keep it under wraps. And from the first night that I saw girls sparring in the ring, and one clear desire that they were expressing with their bodies, with their sheer physical presence, was the desire to take up space, to be strong and powerful with their bodies, to not get knocked down, and to prevail against somebody else in the ring. And that there was a kind of glee in this, that when I saw girls sparring in the ring that first night, their friends and the mother of the Rodriguez sisters were, you know, kneeling up on the ring apron watching the sparring and sort of laughing and cheering. And that confused me. In a way, it seemed wrong that you would laugh and cheer when someone was getting hit and hitting. But at the same time, it seemed like maybe there was something right about it, that there was something joyful about what was going on. It was that first night, what it really was a mystery to me. And I think the reason I kept going back and that I began training and began sparring was because I had to try to unravel the mystery.
Hmm. So it sounds like maybe from what you're saying is that, you know, in as much as we have said so much about equality of the sexes and opportunities for women and so forth, that we're still, that women, even today, you know, we're get one way or another, directly, indirectly, subtle, not so subtle, we're giving messages to our daughters and our young women that, yes, it's true, you're equal, and yes, you can do whatever you want, and you can go to college, and you can be an astronaut, and whatever, but that somehow there is still that message that says, but don't forget. Women really, though, are supposed to be nice and quiet and a little shy and reserved. They're not supposed to be loud. They're not supposed to be physical. They're not supposed to be into hitting. They're supposed to be into giving and caring and taking care of other people, and that for someone like you or these girls or other women who would be attracted either to boxing or could be other things that are intensely physical, that are loud, that are about standing out, that are about standing up and saying, look at me, I am strong. Don't mess with me. Don't come to me with all sorts of assumptions about who it is you think I am, because if you give me the chance, I'll tell you that all of that is about wanting to toss aside all that programming, all those things that we continue to say to little girls, here's the book, here's the manual, read it. This is what a girl and a woman is supposed to be. It's taking that book and tearing up and throwing it away and saying, well, no, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I grew up thinking that I was growing up in a post-feminist era. You know, I thought sexism had pretty much been put to rest. You know, I thought this is great. We are equal now. Everybody gets that, and we can proceed. And it didn't hit me until adulthood that there were some more subtle, insidious remnants of sexism. You know, that I had swallowed hook, line, and sinker, and that we're not beyond the age of sexism. Maybe it's just gotten sort of, it's gotten translated into more subtle messages.
Hmm. We talked a little bit earlier about the attraction, maybe for a lot of women and girls, the attraction of athletics and athletic competition. And you talked about the fact that your editor, when you would give her chapters of the book, which was about boxing, your editor, who was a very serious tennis player, could understand that. Could understand what that was about. There is with boxing a class dimension, though. It is one of those things that probably for a lot of kids, depending on the kind of background they come out of, maybe tennis would not be an option for them. Golf, downhill skiing, you know, there are certain things that they just wouldn't have access to. But boxing is something that they would have access to. I mean, is there some sort of a... Do you think there is some sort of connection between that having that opportunity or being limited in your other opportunities and class and the situation that you come out of?
Yeah, I do think that's part of it. The Somerville Boxing Club, which is where most of the book is set, they started 20, 25 years ago in a very working class neighborhood. And from the beginning, a huge part of their mission was to serve the at-risk youth in the neighborhood. And when I say serve at-risk youth, that wasn't actually quite the language that they would use. It's not like these were, you know, holier than thou people coming in and offering a great social service. All of the founders of the club, you know, were themselves from really difficult upbringings, and it was more that they wanted to provide for the kids that they now saw growing up in their own neighborhoods around them, something that would be like a refuge and a haven and a place that was tough enough that it would be, you know, legitimate to the kids and would resonate with the kids, but that first and foremost was providing some kind of a safe, protective service. And there was such a clear sense that the kids who were serious about coming to the gym and working out every afternoon or evening, you know, by definition could not be the kids who were getting involved with drugs and theft and, you know, the judicial system. So there is a sense of a clear correlation between boxing in impoverished neighborhoods and offering a service to the youth of those neighborhoods.
Mm. Rafaela, she, as you tell in the book, the story sort of concentrates on her and these girls. There are some boys there, and she does also work with boys. Was her interest sort of in more general and working with young people who wanted to fight, or was there a particular interest that she had in working with girls?
Well, as you said, she was happy to work with any kid who came, you know, with the hunger and the need to try the sport on. But she did have a particular interest in working with girls. I think because of her own experience growing up, she knew that whatever the boys in the neighborhood were dealing with, girls would be dealing with that, and then layered on top of it, they'd be dealing with, you know, whatever gender stereotypes might be keeping them down, and not only gender stereotypes, but the real physical threat of coming to harm at the hands of, you know, boys and men in the neighborhood. And that's a reality for girls everywhere. It may be particularly dangerous for girls who are growing up in neighborhoods that are perceived just to have more, you know, higher rates of crime and alcoholism and drug use and poverty, and all of that.
Mm-hmm. When the story begins, the two oldest girls are 15. So now I guess they would be 18 or 19.
Yes.
What can you say that there were some things in their life who they are now, where they are now, that was a direct result of them having had this experience?
One of them has not graduated from high school. She started out this past fall repeating her senior year, but I don't know how much school she had even attended at that point. And it's interesting and sad to me, but also realistic to say that boxing does not seem to have, you know, been the panacea for her. She's a beautiful, smart, you know, strong young woman, but there's no clear sense right now that she is carving out for herself a life of deliberate choice, you know, that's going to be an improvement on what she was handed. And I guess I say that it feels sort of realistic and appropriate because it would be absurd of me to say, you know, I've found it. I've found the thing that's going to save, you know, at-risk youth. It makes sense that it's not going to work for everybody. And, she is only 19. Her story is far from over yet. But right now, she's not necessarily doing so great. Her friend, who also is 19 this month, Nikki, has done amazing things that everybody, when I first met her, everybody, you know, predicted only trouble for Nikki. Things were terrible for her in her family life and at school, and she didn't think too highly of herself. And she has become such a strong, clear-minded, poised young woman, and she's a freshman at a four-year college now, which itself is, you know, it seems like a marvel. And she talks about her experience at the boxing gym being an important and direct factor in what enabled her to make that leap out of where she was when she was 15. And so the message I draw from that is that you can see in some people the signs of what the boxing experience has done, how it's transcended the ring and had an influence in the rest of their lives. But it's not going to be a fairy tale ending or a quick fix for anyone.
Yeah, that does seem in her case to be a really remarkable kind of turnaround, in the sense that in the beginning of the story, when you meet her, she has this very difficult and troubled relationship with her mother. She seems to just be filled with rage. She's gotten in a lot of fights, and that in part as a result of the experience, though, she seems to have her family relationships improved.
Yeah.
She got more serious and got better at school. That in so many respects, her life seems to be better as a result of having had that experience.
Yes.
How much of that do you think was in finding a kind of I don't know if it's going too far to say that Rafaela became kind of a surrogate mother, but that she was giving her, Nikki, probably giving her some of the kind of stuff that her mother was not.
Yeah, I think that Rafi believed in Nikki so much and was also a safer person than maybe her own mother could have been. And when I say safer, I mean it may be hard and you know, very unusual for an adolescent to come to her mother with everything and, you know, open up to her and tell her all kinds of things. There is sort of a natural separation going on between daughter and mother at that time. And so Rafi sort of provided that stand-in adult female role model figure, but because she wasn't Nikki's mother, and there wasn't any negative history between them, Nikki could come to her. I will mention, you know, yeah, it's probably going a bit far to call her a surrogate mother, but Rafi was working as a graphic designer, and that's what Nikki's major is right now in college. So that does seem significant to me.
So do you spend much time in the ring these days?
Well, the sad thing about boxing gyms is that the real, you know, the kind of down and dirty boxing gyms never take in a lot of money. Both of the gyms I write about in the book have since closed, but John Hazard, the second trainer I worked with just a month ago, reopened a gym in Boston, and I have been down there several times, and it feels great to put the gloves back on and step in the ring.
Can you talk a little bit more about what that's like for someone who has never had that experience?
Before I sparred for the first time, I was really scared. I wasn't actually scared of getting hurt, but I was just mortified, scared, thinking that I might cry the first time I got hit in the face. I was just desperate for that not to happen. But I had read that for a lot of people, it's an involuntary response. So the first time I sparred and I did get hit in the face, and it was kind of hard, but it didn't hurt and I didn't cry, and I didn't even have to fight a physical impulse to turn around or back away. I just experienced exhilaration. I felt so strong and capable. I felt mentally strong or emotionally strong. And then as I began to trust my sparring partner more, trust myself to go ahead and make contact and hit her, you know, land actual blows, and trust that she wasn't rattled by it, that that's what we were here to do. Then it became this incredibly, almost zen-like, clarifying, strangely peaceful time inside the ring where you're working on skills and strategy. It was an aspect of myself that I had never tapped into before, that kind of strength and confidence and clarity.
I think you touch on something when you mention, you talk about skills and strategy. I think that's also something that people who don't know about boxing, who've never been involved and who have just maybe seen it, get the idea that it's really all about strength, and certainly strength is important, but that there are skills involved that probably surprise you when you first start doing it, and that there is strategy involved, and that it's probably a lot harder and more physical demanding even than it looks.
That's true. I'll tell you, since when the gyms closed down and I couldn't, you know, find a place to train, I went to the local health club and they had a boxing class and I took that for a month, but it was so different from the real thing. I got frustrated and I quit that. And then I started taking ballet there and I loved it. And in a weird way, I feel like ballet and boxing have so much in common. They're both so physically difficult and so physically precise and require such discipline and a kind of grace and a kind of concentration. That in my mind, you know, the analogy, the best analogy for boxing is ballet.
I like that idea. Down at the Y, we have a combination boxing and ballet class.
No, really?
We get the guys and the girls together, and we get everybody everybody working on both skills and the skills that you can
do. I'd like to see that.
Now there is, because of this movie, Clint Eastwood's movie, Million Dollar Baby, I'm sure that there is a lot of attention being focused on the subject of boxing. And just yesterday, just sort of for grins, I went to the LexisNexis database and just put in women and boxing and, of course, got a gazillion hits. And most of them were references to the movie because it had just won the Academy Award. But I'm sure that the kind of interest that the movie gets then also gets people, you know, reporters, journalists, writers around the country looking for real life examples. And I know that that has happened too, that reporters have gone out and somewhere in their neighborhood, they find some women fighter and say, you know, you've seen the movie, but this is the real thing. And that predates this, what you're doing and what a lot of other people have written about predates the movie. I wonder if you think that as a result of the film, that's going to result in some uptick of interest by women in boxing, and then whether that is just going to be sort of a fad, or would that be a way of actually building some actually long-term kind of interest in support for getting more women involved in the sport?
It does seem likely to me that there will be a surge of interest, and I could imagine that a lot of that interest might get sort of funneled off into the, you know, cardio boxing health club boxing style classes that get offered. And then I could imagine that some of it does result in more women going to authentic boxing gyms. If it does have a permanent effect on the numbers of women boxers, it would be great for the sport because the sport is still quite young. It was only recognized by USA Boxing in the 90s. And when you don't have a lot of trained athletes in a sport, you know, the merits of the sport, it's hard. What am I trying to say? You know, it's hard for the level of all the athletes to rise. So the more women who are training, the better the competition gets, the better the skill level of the athletes will have to get in order to stay competitive in competition. And it would be nice to see women's boxing continue to gain in respect as a pure sport. And I think that will... that would be helped by increased numbers of women boxing.
Yeah. I'm sure that some people would feel that one of the things that would really help boost the sport would be to have women in boxing at the Olympic level. Is that something that people are talking about?
Yeah, it has been talked about. I don't know the latest. I know people are talking about 2008. I've also heard that at one point, at least, the Olympic Committee was considering taking boxing out of the Olympics altogether because it has such an unsavory kind of, you know, quality to it. I think it would be great to have more emphasis on Olympic boxing and less emphasis on professional boxing, you know, which sometimes slides into, you know, almost grotesque parody the way professional wrestling is so different from the amateur and, you know, purely athletic type of wrestling. So if Olympic style boxing, amateur boxing were more visible, I think it would gain the sport more respect in the general public's eyes.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. If you'd like to read more, look for this book we mentioned. It's titled Without Apology, Girls, Women, and the Desire to Fight. It's published by Random House by our guest, Leah Hager-Cohen. Ms. Cohen, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Today's programming is made possible in part by a grant from Birkenstock Concepts by Heel to Toe in downtown Urbana. For over 25 years, offering all sizes and widths of Birkenstocks, from clogs and sandals to work, dress, and sport shoes, Birkenstock Concepts offers repair and modification services and a certified podorthist and orthotist on the staff. The broadcast also made possible with support from Warden Martin Subaru, a Subaru Stellar Performer certified dealership, now in their new location in front of the Savoy 16 Theater across from Warden Martin Nissan. Information on the web at wardenmartin.subaru.com. That's it for us here on Focus. We want you to stay tuned, though. Coming up next, there's much more as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Good morning. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk about China and its booming economy. Our guest will be journalist Ted Fishman, author of China, Inc. Let's turn our attention now, 2 minutes before noon, to what's happening on the Chicago Board of Trade. March wheat, 332.5, down 4.75. July, 347, down 4.5. March corn, 212, down 2.5. May, 220.25, down 2.5. July, 227.25, down 2.5. December corn, 240.25, that down 1.75. March beans, 609.25, down 6.25. May, 617, down 5. November, 616, down 3. March meal, 182.50, down 50. March oil, 22.83, down 39. March feeder cattle, $100 even, that up 85 cents. March live cattle, 87.35, up 145. April lean hog, 74.55, up 32.5.